You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.
Hi, everyone. This is John Mandrola from theheart.org Medscape Cardiology, and this is This Week in Cardiology for April 27, 2018. This week, lipid-lowering therapy, obesity, non-steroidals, chronic total occlusion PCI, and wearable technology. First up is the lipid-lowering study. Now, two background points first. That old teaching has it that the baseline LDL doesn't matter for CV risk reduction, especially in secondary prevention. For instance, the CTT collaboration found benefits of statins were proportional to the degree of LDL lowering and no interaction for treatment effects on baseline LDL. And statins and PCSK9 inhibitors lower LDL level by a percentage from the baseline. So the magnitude of the LDL lowering is a function of both how high the baseline LDL level is and also the drug efficacy. So a newly published meta-analysis in JAMA asked the question of whether the baseline LDL level is associated with total or CV mortality. The authors wondered whether the lack of mortality benefit in more recent trials, such as Fourier, for instance, may have been because those trials enrolled individuals with lower baseline LDL. Now, this was a massive study of 34 trials and hundreds and thousands of patients. About half the patients received more intensive lipid lowering and half received less intensive lipid lowering. Big numbers in this trial. The authors did find that more intensive LDL lowering was associated with greater reductions in all-cause mortality when compared to less intensive lipid lowering, but this was only when baseline LDL levels were greater than 100. And trials with baseline LDLs greater than 160 had the greatest reduction in all-cause mortality. Therefore, the main argument of this study is against the use of LDL targets as the sole guide to therapy. It also questions the notion of routinely using multiple LDL-lowering drugs to achieve extremely low LDL levels. And that obviously has huge implications for the use of the new and expensive PCSK9 drugs. Now, Drs. Navarre and Peterson from Duke wrote an excellent editorial in which they cite the possibility of an ecological fallacy with this meta-analysis. And an ecological fallacy is complicated, but it occurs when conclusions about an individual are inappropriately deduced from group-level statistics. And the editorialists worry that using trial-level data, like they did in the meta-analysis, to show people with higher LDL had greater benefits. But they thought, unless individual-level data is analyzed, one cannot be sure if the observed differences were true. In other words, are the observed differences really due to the higher baseline LDL, or are they confounded by other trial-related differences? Now, the editorialists also point to other possible confounders, such as we're a lot better at taking care of MIs now than we were when the first statin trials were started. And better secondary prevention tends to reduce cardiovascular events and long-term mortality, which, of course, makes it harder to show differences with more intensive lipid lowering. So the bottom line is there's some uncertainty here, but when considering more intensive lipid lowering, we should think about both the initial LDL level, but also the patient's overall risk, and that patients at high risk may still get large absolute risk reductions, even if there's a potential blunting of the relative risk reduction with a lower LDL level. And perhaps someday, as the editorialist suggests, the open science movement will allow patient-level analysis of these trials and will better be able to target the use of these drugs. So the next topic is on obesity. Now, you can learn a lot from longitudinal studies like the MESA study, which is the multi-ethnic study of atherosclerosis. And MESA recruits patients from six U.S. centers and then follows them over years. This study group has more than 6,800 patients, and the most recent analysis probed the status of obese patients who some, but not me, call metabolically healthy. So the quote, metabolically healthy obese patient has no other cardiac risk factors and has not yet had heart disease. The authors report that metabolically healthy obesity did not increase the odds of having a cardiovascular event, but it did significantly increase the odds of developing metabolic syndrome. and the authors concluded that metabolically healthy obesity is not a stable or reliable indicator for future risk of cardiovascular disease, and that weight loss and lifestyle management should be recommended to all those with obesity. I agree totally, but I really have a problem with the modifier metabolically healthy for obesity. My take, and maybe some will object to this, is that the medical profession does people a great disservice by normalizing obesity. We needn't be mean to people with obesity, but we should not normalize it either by saying that it's metabolically healthy. And a final comment here is that authors from this MESA cohort note as one of the limitations the fact that they did not have info on cardiorespiratory fitness. This, they say, is a problem because previous analyses suggest obese individuals with good fitness do well. The thing is, I don't see many obese people who have good cardiorespiratory fitness. Third topic this week is non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, NSAIDs. Now, the opioid epidemic here in the United States has increased the importance of having any news on NSAIDs. This week, two FDA panels voted that the cardiovascular safety of celecoxib is non-inferior to naproxen and ibuprofen. This means that the FDA panels confirmed the findings of the PRECISION trial. And PRECISION was a huge non-inferiority trial that tested the cardiovascular safety of the three non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents in more than 24,000 patients with osteoarthritis or rheumatoid arthritis. And the rates of a composite outcome of CV death, MI, or stroke range from about 2.3 to 2.7% per year, and these were not statistically different. But of course, the problem with the PRECISION trial was its lack of precision, meaning two-thirds of the patients stopped taking their assigned drug, and about a quarter of the patients discontinued follow-up. And these are huge problems for the external validity of the trial, or at least how to generalize this trial. And I think the FDA is probably right, but proclaiming equal cardiovascular safety probably should come with wide confidence intervals. Finally, I have changed my tune a little bit on NSAIDs over the recent years. I used to be a super anti-NSAID evangelist, but now I've come to see the competing dangers of immobility and alternative pain meds such as opioids. I try to minimize doses of NSAIDs, and I try to get patients to use them intermittently or to see if acetaminophen will work as well, if possible. But sometimes there are no other good options. Fourth topic today is chronic total occlusion of coronary artery and PCI of a CTO. A new registry study presented at the SCAI meeting, the Society for Cardiac Angiography, and published simultaneously in a journal, JACC Cardiovascular Interventions, finds that opening chronic total occlusions is growing more successful. The PROGRESS CTO study is an uncontrolled registry of CTO occlusion procedures at 20 centers in the U.S., Europe, and Russia. The main results of this study were that technical success was achieved in 85% of patients. That's better than previous studies. 3% of these patients had major complications and 0.85% died. And I certainly have no doubt that CTO-PCI is getting better with procedural iterations. But I asked to what end. Thus far, the RCTs looking at outcomes and angina relief compared to medical therapy are negative. And the new findings of Orbita certainly crush the idea of doing CTO-PCI just for angina relief. The new standard for angina relief has to be a placebo-controlled or sham trial. And you know, CTO-PCI would be a great thing to study with a sham procedure, as there is certainly minimal risk from the sham procedure itself, as the artery is already occluded. The other comment about procedures like CTO-PCI is that this would be a great thing to have reimbursement for only for patients enrolled in studies. Just consider, for instance, if every patient who has had a CTO-PCI was enrolled in a study or even a controlled registry or pragmatic trial, we'd already know a lot about whether it worked. Fifth topic, final topic, is about wearables. Now, the truest statement I've read all week was made in regard to the expansion of the use of wearables. Quote, "The next 5 to 7 years will be turbulent for us practicing physicians." I think that's exactly right. I see a patient almost every clinic day who has a question or issue about their heart rate monitor or blood pressure monitor or pulse ox monitor or iPhone ECG or some other wearable. Now, sometimes these devices can help. For instance, I've used the iPhone ECG to identify arrhythmias such as AFib, but far more often they have the effect of bringing healthy people into the healthcare system. And I am sorry to say that, and this may upset you, but bringing healthy people into the healthcare system can be dangerous. In my opinion, healthy people have a much greater odds of being harmed by coming in contact with healthcare than they do of being helped. Consider, for instance, the case of the woman who gets a severe skin rash, then cellulitis from a Holter monitor done for asymptomatic bradycardia. This may change in future generations once we figure out the normal distribution of bodily data from these wearables. I often keep the normal curve up on my whiteboard so as to explain the fact that normal people can have values on the tails of these curves, such as high resting heart rates or low resting heart rates that are totally normal. So that's it for this week in cardiology. I'm grateful that you listened. Thank you. This is John Mandrola from the Heart.org Medscape Cardiology.
You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from the Heart.org on Medscape.